The Umbrella Finance Marketing Summit food program is not available. Check out all the confirmed speakers and sessions we have announced. And if you haven't already booked your ticket, hurry. Secure you and your team a place at the finance event of the year at umbrella.com.au/finance.
Welcome back to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Callum Jasmine, and today we're recording live from Mumbrella 360, our biggest in-person event since 2019. Well, it won't be live by the time this gets to you. Bit of a fast and loose one for today's episode. We have a few news topics to get through. We're kind of weaved in with a couple of wee interviews from today's event as well. You'll hear from Anne Parsons, Phil Hall, Margie Reed, Nicole Sparshot, Dr. Norman Swan, and the Mumbrella team. That team today joining me, acting managing editor Andrew Banks. Banksy, how are you doing?
Great to be here, Cal.
Great to see you in person. Kalila, journalist, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. So nice to be in a crowd of people despite, maybe I shouldn't say that actually.
No, it's fine. You've had COVID yourself last week, so you're very...
I'm fine. I'm in the clear.
Very welcome to say that. And a podcast, very exciting debut for editorial assistant Darcy Song.
Thank you, Callum, for taking me off the blacklist.
Yeah, you were on the blacklist, and it was a beautiful promotional read that you just kicked us off with there. How is everyone enjoying their first 360? It's obviously mine as well. Darcy, you're taking the show by storm. What have you made of it so far?
I think it's been going pretty well. Haven't seen anything extraordinary apart from Banksy's outfit.
What did you think of the croissants?
No opinion. Haven't tried it.
Well, you guys have been slogging away this morning, getting our newsletter out. So doing the engine room.
Thanks,
work.
Cal.
Yeah, well, we all appreciate it. Kalila, what are you making of it so far? You'll be on stage tomorrow.
I will be. Today I've gotten to do a little bit of everything. Newsletter this morning, and I've had a chance to pop to a few sessions, which has been good. Everyone's saying good things. Everyone seems to be really keen to be here. So that's always nice to hear.
Well, that's what we'd want people to think.
That's definitely what everyone is saying to us.
Can I just add too, I'm really impressed with the team editorially, and the events team have been really good. So it's been a good sesh so far.
Well, I'm glad to hear that everyone thinks we're doing a good job from the Mumbrella team.
Pat on the back, everyone.
So anyway, let's get to the first piece of news for this week. Monday was looking like a bit of a quiet morning, and then we got news that Woolworths Group subsidiary and retail media business Cartology has agreed a deal to purchase Shopper Media for a cool $150 million in a deal that has sort of placed significant emphasis on that business for Woolworths and kind of signals, I guess, its importance to their strategy moving forward. Kalila, can you just run us through a bit of the details of this one, and then we'll kind of look at where this might be taking Cartology?
Yeah, sure. So a really big move for Cartology, with Shopper having 2,000 screens across 400 shopping centres in Australia. So they are somewhat of a retail media giant in the market. The company rebranded from Shopper Media Group to Shopper in 2021, and there's been a few shifts at the company as well this year following the very sad passing of co-founder and CEO Ben Walker in January this year, after which his founding partner Ed Koosh moved from the COO role into the CEO role. In other news for the company, they also joined the Outdoor Media Association in March earlier this year. So a lot to come potentially from this purchase for Woolworths and Cartology. What are your thoughts, Cal?
It's a bit early to say, to be honest, because I think it will really depend on how Cartology looks to keep that business when the deal eventually does go through, which they, I think, predicted to be close to the end of this year. Whether or not they decide to kind of keep it as a separate entity, as you know, that sort of separate digital out of home business to kind of complement Cartology, or whether they kind of bring it in and change the structure, kind of integrate Koosh and the I think it's about 150 employees at Shopper. That's off the top of my head, it could be incorrect. Spoke to Mike Tyquin briefly after the announcement yesterday. And he said, again, it's a bit early to say in terms of the change in structure, whether it will stay that standalone business. But for the next while, the shopper business will kind of continue business as usual until that deal goes through. Although he did say it's an incredibly complementary business that will fit well with the kind of group structure.
Yeah, that's strange, Cal. We've got a situation where Cartology's, on the one hand, they're saying that it's complementary, but yet they're not at this stage prepared to.
Well, I think it's just a bit early when the deal hasn't gone through to be, you know, I think they'd be very careful to not make any statements. I guess the deal isn't done. So, yeah, I mean, the space is certainly interesting at the moment. We saw the launch of a new business, Zitcher, a few weeks ago from Jack Byrne, the founder and owner of Hatched Media, launched that with his business partner, Troy. So, yeah, and then Cole's obviously launching earlier this year. We'll have some stuff coming up on that in a few weeks.
Do you think that the ACCC will approve it at the end of the year?
Oh, you would think so. I don't see why.
I think it'll be really interesting, like, for example, if they do, you know, look at a more kind of integrated model, if they do bring Shopper into Cartology, what's that going to look like? Are you going to walk into a shopping centre and there's just Woolworths, like, or, you know, Cartology kind of media spots everywhere through the whole shopping centre? It feels like it could be really interesting how they're going to roll that out.
It kind of gives them a pretty strong position in the market.
Yeah, I mean, like, kind of monopolising a shopping centre, it's an interesting proposition.
That's a good point too, because whenever I go to Kmart, I just think I'm in Anko.
Anyway, looking at staying on the topic of digital out of home, I chatted to global media advisor Anne Parsons, who's over here with QMS for 360, alongside Ocean Outdoor UK's joint managing director Phil Hall, about how the digital out of home space is sort of growing and how they're sort of discussing how it ties in with opportunities in the metaverse. Here's that interview now. So Anne Parsons and Phil Hall here. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're preparing to go on stage very soon for your headline session here at Mumbrella 360. Phil, if you could just, I guess, run us through the top line, what the session's about before we get into everything else.
Yeah, I think really we're going to talk about digital out of home and the power of digital out of home, but more specifically about how that works in the metaverse. Ocean Outdoor have entered the metaverse and dropped some sites into the metaverse. And I think what the audience will want to hear about is why we've done that, how transacting that sort of that digital out of home method works in a virtual world, and what the opportunities are for advertisers there.
Yeah, and was this something maybe for you that seemed like a natural connection, or is it something that maybe when you kind of looked to delve into it a bit more, you thought, oh, well, that does make a lot of sense?
Well, we actually wanted to find a media owner who was already playing in the metaverse space, so that we were talking to someone who stepped in there and could speak from a position of real knowledge. And I guess maybe not surprisingly, it was a digital out-of-home business that we identified, because the ongoing growth of digital out-of-home is totally inspired by what's happening digitally. And here was Ocean, who are arguably the most innovative and digitally connected out-of-home premium out-of-home player in the market. So that made the connection really very natural and a perfect running mate for us.
Yeah.
And then it's Phil who's actually driving that in out of home and for Ocean. So hence the conversation, and every conversation that sprung from that, it was just something that was a perfect fit and what we believe is great education for the Australian market.
Phil, what do you sort of make of the digital out-of-home market, maybe in Australia at the moment, being a sort of premium player in that space? Do you think it is sort of, it is being adopted kind of as progressively as you would maybe like to see for the wider market?
I think if you look at digital out-of-home in most of the developed countries in the world, to where it is now to where it was 7 or 8 years ago, it's like night and day. It's mm-hmm. And I think sometimes one of the frustrations that I have is I'm not sure all the time that that is recognised, whether it be by clients or the creative community or by the buyer side. I think often it is, but there's still patches where people still think of out of home as it was a while back. And if you look at what's possible now with the quality of the screens, mm-hmm. The technological innovations, the increased creativity we see, the better content on those screens, there it's a really, really strong advertising opportunity. And I think we're in a world where, you know, I think most of us, whether you're young or old, are getting pretty adept at ad avoidance. People put mm-hmm. ad blockers on their phones, people fast forward through TV ads, there's a lot of ad skipping going on wherever possible. And you've got a medium in digital out of home that is unavoidable, unskippable, super premium, great sight lines, carrying increasingly interesting and engaging messages. And so I think the future looks really bright. I think the present is really bright, but I think what's as I think most people would accept that ad avoidance on other media is only going to go one way. It's only going to go up. Yeah. And yet the quality of the inventory and the messaging on digital out of home is getting better and better.
That's a really interesting point that you raised too, Phil, because there is a gap that hopefully will close quickly about how well creative is executed on a digital screen. And if you think about how much work and investment and joy creative on the television screen does give, some of that needs to start migrating to a digital out-of-home screen because the big audiences of television are now there on an out-of-home screen. The opportunity for motion but for content is there, so it's still pretty much an area that has not been capitalised upon.
I totally agree with that. I think I was walking through the city, it's my first time in Sydney for 20 years and the city's changed a lot, and I walked past some of the new QMS screens that have gone in as part of the City of Sydney contract, and they're beautiful looking, and these are high quality screens that you would happily have in your front room. And I think the challenge to advertisers is to think about that, how you can put that really strong creative message into street furniture there, because it's going to deliver and it's going to engage.
And we kind of, you know, you speak about some of these really creative opportunities. From your, I guess you've got this incredible background across multidisciplinary media space. Whose onus do you think it is to kind of continue to drive that product and the creative, I guess, product that we're going to actually end up seeing on these screens? I know we do have these fantastic examples, you know, in Times Square and mm-hmm. Shanghai, where mm-hmm. you see these fantastic pieces of digital mm-hmm. out of home. Mm-hmm. To make that more ubiquitous, who do you think, where's the onus on that?
Well, I think it's a real collaborative thing. I think that it's media agency with creative agency, and the media owner needs to be involved as well. The more that we go down this path of engagement and attention, the media owners are, through their own investment into research, understanding a great deal about how that's working and how it works for digital out of home. So some of that learning can help creatives really hone in on what's going to work. But I think that a genuine valuing of what's happening creatively, and that is, you know, it's the old thing, it's been the classic in media agencies forever. I'm sure you'll agree, Phil, the old get the creative guys involved early on and let them understand that this is going to be a digital out of home campaign, so that they can really spend time thinking about how they want to bring that to life. But it's no one's fault, but it's the good old lack of communication, mm-hmm. collaboration that needs to happen a bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're seeing, I guess, the rise in that value and appreciation of the digital out-of-home space. Mm-hmm. This week, Woolworths Group purchased, I don't know if you saw, Shopper Media for a cool price of $150 million. We're definitely seeing the opportunities there, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
But absolutely. And Ocean have had their own experience in being extremely well valued and recently purchased at only a very fine, fair, but nevertheless high price. And that's because it is recognised as being what I would say is like the future screen, and what television was, because it has that kind of capability in a marketplace where getting big reach is really disappearing for every other channel. that's okay because that's just the evolution of media. Mm-hmm. But the last woman standing is digital out of home.
Well, I appreciate both of you making the time and look forward to your session this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
With pleasure.
Next up, Thinkabell signaled last Friday afternoon that it's looking to launch into New Zealand if it can find the right partners. I caught up with CEO Margie Reed today at our event for a quick chat about that. Here it is. Margie Reed, CEO of Thinkabell, how are you?
Great, thanks, Kel. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Loving the busy day here at 360.
Big buzz.
Yeah, did you catch Adam's session before?
No, I didn't. I missed it. But I did see Anuba from Lion, so she was fantastic on the culture stage.
Well, I hope you'll stick around and see a few more sessions. So the reason we wanted to chat is that on Friday you sent out, you and the agency sent out, your intentions to launch into New Zealand. It would be great to, get your perspective on why now is the time to kind of signal that and the thoughts behind it.
Absolutely. And that's obviously if New Zealanders will have us. We certainly don't want to, you know, take Australia over to New Zealand. We want to be a New Zealand-based business, building on, obviously, a market that is just so rich with creativity. And we are all about creativity. If we can't be in the world's mecca of creativity, then... and we want to be part of, you know, creativity where it lives and breathes at its utmost.
And it is very preliminary at this stage, isn't it? You're kind of getting the feelers out, getting the bit of matchmaking going. Is that kind of the plan?
Absolutely.
You're heading over there as well?
Yep, heading over there, having some meetings with different people, and we're literally early days to see if the right partners, and that's business partners who would have an equity in Thinkabell with us, would be in the market and ready to do it together.
Do you see Thinkabell as being a good fit for New Zealand? I know the Australian and New Zealand markets are often kind of lumped in together. You know, we see it with all these executive roles, their ANZ roles. Do you think that's just a natural progression?
From the response, absolutely. We've been inundated with responses and the welcoming nature of it, you know, from people who want to just have a chat with us through to people who want to be business partners. It's absolutely phenomenal. So if the timing's right and the people are right, then hopefully, you know, it'll be the right business decision for us.
And we were talking about with our colleague, you don't work for Mumbrella, my colleague Kalila before, about how Thinkabell is just kind of producing work at a pretty prolific rate at the moment. Do you think that first of all, I guess, why is that at the moment that you've got so much output, and do you think that will be a good thing to kind of showcase what the company is and diversity of what you produce to any potential partners?
Absolutely. I think it goes back to our model. You know, measured magic is our proposition, but how we lean into solving problems in a way that is, you know, both from a macro level of solving, you know, brand problems through to how do you go down the funnel with a client, but that's also across the spectrum from brand, you know, to the distribution across paid, owned and earned, and shared. So I guess because of that depth and breadth, it allows us to be creating quite a lot of work. And from a New Zealand point of view, I think it absolutely will. I mean, creativity is driven in that market, and from the response of the people that we're having chats with, I think they're hungry for our model, and I think there's an appetite to at least see if Thinkabell East, as we call it, can work in that market.
All that's left is West, then, and you'll have them all ticked off.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for coming on and saying hi, Maggie.
Thanks, Kel. Have a good day.
And Kalila, as we heard there, obviously early days, but what is your thoughts on potentially launching a third market East for Thinkabell?
I think that it really makes sense for them, to be honest. So a couple of years ago, July 2020, the agency was sitting at about 57 staff members. And according to LinkedIn, they're now at around 122. So that's more than doubling in the last few years, or last couple of years, I should say. So I guess going, you know, across the sea, it makes sense for them, the next step. They're also looking to move into a new, bigger Sydney office in the next couple of months. And they've obviously got their office down in Melbourne. So it's kind of looking like they're on a pretty steady growth trajectory. So it seems like the next natural step, as I was saying to Margie earlier today, they're producing a lot of work locally alone. So I think, you know, moving into New Zealand, that'd just kind of step up their capacity as well to continue producing the kind of unique work they've been doing at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting when you've got the kind of naming strategy of north in Sydney, south in Melbourne, and then I think they're referring to this as east, as Margie kind of said. I said to her in that interview there, all that's left is west. So you wonder when they do eventually look to expand beyond there, what kind of naming structure they'll...
Perth.
Yeah, Perth.
Well, yeah, one to look out for there. Speaking of Thinkabell, Darcy, you were on hand to catch the session today, the indies that broke through the barrier and how they did it, which featured Thinkabell's co-founder, Adam Ferrier. Who else was on that one and what did you make of it?
I was indeed there, and I think along joining Adam in the session, there were also Philip Smith from Apparent. There were also James Dixon from Atomic 212 and also Lindsay Evans from Special Group. I think overall it was a very interesting session, and it was a full house. I walked in like 3 minutes late and literally couldn't find a spot like in the first 20 rows.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
It was a very interesting session. I think overall it's very good to see how indies are coming through in, I guess, an industry where a lot of the assets are dominated kind of by networked agencies, and they how they are sort of having their own brand positioning. And it's great to hear how they were saying that they're not constrained by traditional ways of working, and that sort of provides them with a point of difference, and how long-term relationship was really valuable to indies as well. I mean, yeah, it's very evident with works like Uber Eats that was conducted by Specials and all that. So yeah, it was a very interesting session.
Yeah, indie's definitely having a moment in the world. They're definitely a crowd draw at these events. So, moving on, next up, let's hear from Dr. Norman Swan, who I caught up with this morning after his keynote chat with our MC, Darren Woolley.
We have Dr. Norman Swan here fresh off the stage at Mumbrella 360 after his fireside chat with Darren Woolley. How did you enjoy that, Norman?
Oh, it was fun and big audience. It was great. Very responsive audience. Fantastic.
So I didn't unfortunately catch the session. I was downstairs on stage, but I figured we could just chat about. I'd be interested to hear from your perspective after sort of being, in a sense, the face of the COVID response and a media platform, how you thought the medium of podcasting kind of functioned in getting that really crucial messaging out day to day?
Well, from my point of view, it was critical because we created this podcast called CoronaCast with ABC, which rapidly went to several million downloads a month, and with an extraordinary sweep across the populace. And we did it every day, 5 days a week. And it became the go-to place for people to get information. And so I learned a lot about podcasting by doing this. It was extraordinary. I would never have believed we had something like 200,000 questions within 2 or 3 months of starting the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I was a daily listener of the podcast myself on a morning walk, which was all we could really do in Melbourne. I'd be interested to hear what that was kind of like for you on a personal note, sort of being the lightning rod or the face of that response. Did it have a sort of personal toll at any point with you? I imagine you had a lot of interaction online as well from the wider Australian community.
I learned to ignore my Twitter feed and really back off social media because it can be quite toxic. There were times where the attacks, and there still are. I mean, we're speaking now, only 2 days ago I got attacks in the media. So people don't like some of the messages that come when you talk from a science base and when ideology gets in the way. So there were some stressful times, but most of the times it was fine. You at least had something to do and felt you were doing some good.
And did you find, I guess, doing it daily and, you know, very early in the morning, was there any sort of pressure there in order to get that messaging right and ensure that all the, I guess, the messaging that you had going out was correct and, I guess, was pushing things in the right direction?
That was a huge part of the task. Yeah. We usually recorded late afternoon, mm-hmm. but there were times where we came back nearly at midnight. It was posted about 4 a.m.
Yeah.
We came back at midnight to fix it up because things had changed. Things changed really rapidly. And we just tried to get the balance of information right. But the key was trust. And if we made a mistake or information changed, we didn't hang around. We just got right back in and corrected it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Norman, thanks for joining me and appreciate you showing up to Mumbrella 360 this year.
It's been my pleasure. Great fun.
On to the next news item. Another week talking about Dentsu. Early yesterday morning, a report from a trade publication, MI3, said that Danny Bass looks set to be joining Dentsu Media as CEO after he recently left Snap, again citing that he was going to be focusing on his health retreat, Berry Hill Farm.
Used to work with Danny.
Did you at News Corp?
Correct.
Yeah, well, there you go, Banksy. Maybe you're in the running for the Dentsu job as well. Kalila, this wasn't the only move this week from Dentsu, though, was it? They made another appointment in APAC. What's the score there?
Today, the announcement of new APAC CEO Rob Gilby came out. He is set to according to Dentsu, this isn't going to change any of the local structure, with a new local Australian CEO still on the way to replace Angela Tangus after she departs later this year to take on the UK and I role. So Gilby will report to Global Dentsu CEO Wendy Clark.
I found it interesting when this came through because, you know, we have kind of been waiting quite a lot to hear how things play out at Dentsu. They do have a couple of those executive roles there. And it's sort of been a case of, you know, will they change the structure? They've got the new Dentsu creative structure. Will they then look to just implement a Dentsu Media? And then I thought maybe they would just have them reporting into APAC. But yeah, as you said there, we spoke to them and that is not the case. So yeah, all eyes still on Dentsu as we wait to hear what they will come out with. And, you know, also whether or not they will confirm the appointment of Danny Bass, with a few other names still being thrown out there at the moment. Dentsu again said they don't comment on speculation. Back to you again, Kalila. Ten had a pretty good week after it tied up MasterChef last week. It launched its new format show, Hunted, which has since performed pretty well. I only caught the first 10 minutes on Sunday night, but seems like a lot of Australians liked it.
Yeah, Ten would have to be pretty chuffed with their performance over the last week or so, I think. Last week, having wrapped up MasterChef, obviously a favourite amongst Australian viewers, they did top entertainment, I think, with the finale and potentially part one of the finale as well. It did happen over a few episodes. And at that point, they also beat Seven in terms of overall share.
That was on Monday?
No, they did that last week too. So last week, the finale of MasterChef brought in a massive 755,000 Metro viewers.
That's linear.
Linear. As well as 875,000 who tuned in for the winner announcement, which significantly bumped up 10's overall share, bringing them into second place ahead of Seven, which is obviously a little bit of a shift from the norm. And it's happened again this week, which is pretty big for the network, with their new show Hunted having consistently topped entertainment for the first couple of nights of its run. The new format, my housemate tuned into the episode and told my entire household that we all have to catch up because apparently it's that good. And that seems to kind of be the vibe, I guess, with it consistently having the numbers.
Interesting.
But they, as I said, they came second again on Monday night in terms of overall share. And they didn't manage to score that again on Tuesday night. But, you know, I think getting it twice in a matter of a week is probably something that they're not too upset with.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that format plays out. I think, Banksy, we were talking about it on our team chat. The format didn't fare so well overseas. Was that right?
Absolutely. I think Hunted is one of those series that does well initially when people are not used to seeing it. I think in Britain they only had one series and in America they only agreed to one series. So it's pretty much a one and done.
One and done, yeah.
Producer Callum here, just doing a quick fact check on something that was mentioned there. Unfortunately, in the research for this episode, there's another UK drama called Hunted, which was axed after one season. But in fact, the UK version of Hunted, the reality program, did run for multiple seasons. Cheers.
Yeah, so as you say, Caleb, not kind of bucking the usual trend with those 9 and 7 kind of taking the overall share, and it will be interesting to see how 10 kind of continues to move in that way, because they've had a few well rating shows with Have You Been Paying Attention, The Cheap Seats returning, which has proved to be popular, and then again seems like they're going down to the wire with reports on the AFL. They're battling it out with 7 and Foxtel still to get that completed. Now a quick catch-up with Unilever's Australia New Zealand CEO, Nicole Sparshot, who I chatted with today after her session at the sustainability stage hosted by The Works.
Fresh off the stage, Nikki Sparshot, CEO at Unilever Australia New Zealand. Thank you for joining us. How did you enjoy that experience?
I love being in a room with other people that have different perspectives, and I'm like a sponge. I take away more than I probably give.
So I was lucky enough to be in the room there on the Sustaining Tomorrow stage, looking at how brands are kind of incorporating sustainability into their full business strategy. With a company like Unilever, where you have so many kind of unique different brands, how do you ensure that whatever your sustainability journey is equally distributed and kept up, I guess, by all those different brands?
Yeah, so I mean, it starts with understanding the people that we serve. So who is the consumer? How can the brand play a role in their life that's meaningful? And what is the appropriate, salient way of building in purpose and sustainability into that agenda? And we just make it a non-negotiable for all of our brands. So we want every single brand in our portfolio to have a point of view in that space and some material action that makes a difference.
What makes it unique about Unilever? I know you've kind of been making this a focus for quite a bit of time, and you know, we had some other brands that are kind of jumping on that now, which is, you know, very necessary. But why has it been so central to Unilever for so long?
I mean, I think it started with our forefathers like 100 plus years ago. They always had this sensibility around producing products that actually serve society. So, you know, Sir Lord Lever, actually, he wanted to democratise access to hygiene through a soap bar so that Victorian England could all have access to hygiene. It's always been part of what we do. But I think what has made it such an important accelerator in the last 10 years or more is that it's come from the top and it's part of our organisational culture.
Well, Nikki, I know you've got a flight to catch, so I appreciate it and thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure. Thank you. Have a good day.
Now, before we get out of here, any last notes from the day's events so far, or anything you're looking forward to over the next day and a half?
The party afterwards would be nice, just to sort of meet a lot of people from the industry. So I'm really looking forward to that, because it's been all business this morning. So it's been nice to just kind of relax a bit after the first day.
Yeah, look, there's a few more sessions I'm keen to catch and just, you know, writing up a few of the sessions we caught this morning. And, of course, cocktail party will be nice. That's always, it's always good, besides the fact that I have to be back here at 7:30 tomorrow or something.
And then this
you're staying here, aren't you, Cal?
I have to be back here at 7:30 a.m. tomorrow for a full day of moderating. And I must say my most anticipated session for the day has to be the live Mumbrella cast.
You know what? I've been looking forward to that one as well. I heard it's going to be
I think that I've heard it's been fully booked out. People have already been putting their name down for the session. Well,
there's a long wait list.
This has been a paid presentation.
Yeah, we've got Deloitte Digital's Nick Garrett and Mim Haysom from Suncorp Group joining me on stage for that, and that will be released on Tuesday as a special episode. So,
are you going to chat, Kurt, like their big win?
Yes, we will be chatting about that.
I'm excited for that.
Amongst everything else.
So we're getting two pods for the price of one.
Exactly.
These lucky listeners.
Anyway, let's leave things there, because I know we've all got places to be, shows to see and people to talk to. Thank you for joining us this week. And get on mumbrella.com.au for all the content from the event, well as the usual stuff. Thank you, Kalila. Thank you, Darcy. Thank you, Banksy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cal.
I have had so much fun.
And thanks to everyone else that joined us today. See you next week.